Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel, along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Jennifer Greenwood, academic tutor in philosophy, education, and nursing at the University of Queensland in Australia. Her new book, Becoming Human, The Ontogenesis, Metaphysics, and Expression of Human Emotionality, is just out from the MIT Press. Psychological and philosophical theories of the emotions tend to take the developed adult emotional repertoire as the paradigm case for understanding the emotions. From this standpoint, the emotions are usually distinguished into two categories: the basic emotions, like fear and happiness, which are widely shared with other species, and the higher cognitive emotions, such as shame or pride, which are uniquely human or nearly so. Greenwood challenges the standard division and related distinctions, such as which emotions are innate and which are learned. She examines the development of emotions from infancy, and argues that there is just one natural kind, emotions, which have common precursor states that develop within deeply interactive relationship between the assistance soliciting neonate and the assistance providing caregiver. She also argues that this deep functional interaction justifies the claim that the emotions are radically wide. They are a case of extended cognition. And she also argues that language, along with sociocultural context generally, mediates the ontogenesis of human emotions. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Jennifer Greenwood. Are you there?
I am. Hello, Carrie Figdor.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm very happy to be talking about your new book, Becoming Human, The Ontogenesis, Metaphysics, and Expression of Human Emotionality. And it's a very interesting book that, you know, kind of takes on the topic of the emotions from a, you know, surprisingly new standpoint, basically from, you know, how, you know, human emotions develop from the neonate onward. And as a result of that, there's a number of interesting and somewhat controversial conclusions that you come to regarding, the division of the emotions, the typical, I should say, division of the emotions into, you know, your basic emotions and then your higher cognitive emotions, and then debates about whether, you know, some of these are innate and some are learned. And there's other, you know, interesting issues that come up as well in the course of your account. So before we get into the topic itself of the book, can you maybe tell us a bit about your background, how you came to philosophy? I see you had also have a PhD in education as well. So how you came to philosophy, and how you came to write this particular book?
Well, I was a nurse for about 25 years, finishing up as a professor of nursing, and I'd been a professor for 8 years. And my contract was basically up for renewal. And frankly, I felt like I needed a change. And I'd always been interested in philosophy ever since I did my first degree at Exeter, which was surprisingly in curriculum studies. But the course coordinator was a philosopher. And we had a philosophy seminar every Friday afternoon. And I guess that's when I was engaged, really. And then when I went to do my PhD at Leeds, and my supervisor there, Peter Tomlinson, although he was a psychologist, he was actually very interested himself in philosophy, and he'd actually read philosophy when he was in a seminary at Louvain as a young man. And so when I decided it was time for me to have a change, I thought I would pursue something, you know, I'd had a kind of enduring interest in. And also I thought... one of the other things that I really wanted to spend time on was improving my skiing, which is quite difficult in Australia, as you might imagine. So I found I had an opportunity to go to Canada, and there was a really good department of philosophy at the University of Alberta, which was about an hour from Jasper. the ski resort. So I went there. But I only actually got my philosophy PhD in 2013. And I got to sort of write the book because one of my external examiners, who was a very eminent emotion theorist, was very impressed with it. And he suggested that I publish it. And he even told me where it would be appropriate to publish it. Mm-hmm. And when I got in touch with MIT, I found out that he'd already been in touch himself with the editors. And so I kind of rewrote, I suppose, the thesis according to the reviews, which were all very positive, and it got published in December last year.
Well, it's an unusual but very kind of heartwarming kind of trajectory that, you know, someone can come from a very different background and make an impression. That's very worthwhile to know. So let's about the emotions. Okay, so as you noted at the very beginning, and as anybody who has read about the emotions is aware, most of the time, the theories of the emotions kind of start from the point of the adult emotions, the ones that we already have as adults, and these are often divided into, you know, the basic emotions such as anger and fear, and then the higher cognitive emotions such as shame or perhaps pity, things like that. You start from sort of the neonate, the human neonate, and you argue that, you know, from that perspective, this distinction is not really merited. The emotions do form, on your view, some sort of natural kind. But there's just one natural kind, and we can see them both developing in very similar ways from the same precursors. Whether we, as an adult, we sort of divide them into these two ways, but it's not really justified if you look at it from the ontogenetic perspective. So can you say a little bit about, you know, your approach to the emotions and what motivated you to do that?
Yes, I mean, I do think that it is the focus on adult emotionality that leads to the kind of received view of their very distinctive characterization. You know, that they're so distinct that they can't possibly belong to one natural kind. And when I started to read about the emotions the different theorists, it seemed to me that there was the kind of the throb of the emotions was missing. A lot of it, and pardon me for my sort of candor, seemed to me to be a little dry. Well, I'm actually a reasonably emotional creature, and the emotions give color and meaning, and, you know, all of the perturbations in my life. And they just seem to be missing, and I'm not quite sure why. I just decided to have a look at the developmental psychology and see if there was something there that had more blood in it. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I never looked back. All of the color, all of the tos and fros. The nuances that characterize human life and how they developed were there. And as I got into development, of course, I realized that they actually, both HCEs and BEs, although they are characterized as distinct, I mean, they do arise in different areas of the brain. One was supposed to be language dependent, which was the higher cognitive. The other's language independent. One, the basics, were supposed to be homologous with other mammals, where the higher cognitive emotions are characterized as uniquely human. A whole raft of differences. And the story I tell actually shows that they actually, both of them arise from inborn precursors, but through the same kind of developmental mechanisms, which is the interaction of the sort of the what I call the constraints repertoires of neonates and primary caregivers or mothers, and they're both language dependent, and the kind of polarization of biology and culture that's apparent in the literature, it seems to me to be mistaken. The biology and culture, as I hope my book shows, interact continuously throughout the protracted emotional and linguistic development of human beings.
Okay, so, well, you mentioned precursors. Can you say a bit about these common precursors?
Yes, I mean, they're sort of the affect expressions that infants have, that they're born with, are kind of precursors that probably evolved in our ancestral environments in response to certain kinds of stimuli that were dangerous or toxic, challenging, novel, pleasurable, those sorts of things. So the sort of the affect expressions, the precursor emotions that the neonates are born with include kind of precursor fright, disgust, distress, interest, and indulgence, pleasure. Now these are very primitive, and they're progressively sort of developed, but they're kind of they act as signs to primary caregivers of homeostatic and psychological distress or pleasure. And the sort of the fright and disgust and distress manifests as sort of unfocused crying and motor unrest. If you see an infant that is unhappy, they're sort of crying in a kind of monotone, and their limbs are kind of moving as well. And of course, they smile, they coo, and they cuddle up if they're actually pleased about anything. And basically, that's all they have. But fortunately, evolution has pre-adapted. Can I just say mother? I know. I know that you know same-sex men who have families now, but it's generally mother even now, sort of more commonly. That's not meant to disparage any other kind of relationship with infants, but they're pre-adapted with a whole raft of constraints as well, or kind of minimal competences, and the sort of their repertoire is kind of characterized as intuitive parenting skills, and these are perfectly complementary to the constraints repertoires of the precursor emotions, the species typical behavior patterns, and sensory motor competencies that neonates are born with. So the whole developmental process is supported by the continuous interaction of these two repertoires, which managed to bootstrap, you know, development from, you know, what I call the mewling, puking infant to a fully sapient, autonomous individual over a period of 20 years.
Mm-hmm. So let me just, I mean, since you did mention the case of, you know, same-sex marriages or you know, actually, I mean, it doesn't even have to be that just you do emphasize, you know, sort of mothers here. Is there? Do you think there is any difference in terms of the preparation, maybe of men for taking, you know, assuming the caregiving role?
It's a very interesting question that the sort of neurochemicals and prosocial and neuropeptides, endogenous opioids, which men and women are sort of equipped with, are slightly different. I mean, the most important chemical for females is oxytocin, which is responsible for what people call maternal urges, and it's released. It's, you know, actually the women flood with it during any kind of pro-social activity. So whether they're nursing their babies, they're playing with their babies, they're changing their babies, chatting with their babies, doing all those sorts of things, then oxytocin is being released. It's all, you know, they're also flooded with oxytocin when they're having babies during parturition, when they're suckling, but and that's kind of augmented with prolactin, and orgasm. These are the kind of paradigmatic social activities which trigger the release of oxytocin in women, and so you get strong bonding feelings in the woman. In men, they're sort of their primary, I suppose, caring chemical, neurochemical, for want of a better term, is vasopressin. As oxytocin is mainly concerned with a kind of nurturant activities, vasopressin is more concerned with a protection. Now I've been thinking about it, and it seems to me that there might not be too much difference in terms of overt behaviors between the expression of protection, protective behaviors, and nurturing. Mm-hmm. If I'm nurturing, I'm protecting from hunger, for instance, and if I think an infant needs protection, then I hold him or her close. So I think that there may be a lot of overlap in the behaviors. But certainly, I mean, I've looked at the research, and the both research in the US and here in Australia, and it seems to be very reputable research that comes out of reputable universities, and which have kind of looked at what they term reputable studies, show that there is no disadvantage to being brought up by same-sex couples.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really not in a position to know, but it does seem as though if you can be brought up by two men, and your emotional, linguistic, and cognitive development is equal to a child brought up in a sort of heterosexual family, then it seems to me there's absolutely no disadvantage, and men must be able to do it as well as women.
Mm-hmm.
Men anyway.
Okay. So let me, I do want to get into some of the details of your account of ontogenesis. I mean, you have this, you say that the process is, I also want to get to your defenses of, the extended mind aspect of it. But before we get into that, I just want to talk about the account itself in terms of how it happens. So you argue that there's this very deep functional integration between the neonate and, the parent or the mother, we might as well just say, that on your view somehow scaffolds, and there's a number of ways in which that happens, scaffolds the precursor responses into emotions, and that this process is guided by what you call three C's, the constraints, context, and continuity. So can you give us a bit of detail about how the actual developmental process occurs from the precursors to the actual developed emotions?
Well, I'll certainly try. Yes, I mean, I use the term constraints rather than a kind of competencies, because it seems to me to be a better term. The constraints which neonates are born with, equipped with, they limit what she can attend to, and this protects her from overstimulation. If you think of the potential bombardment, stimulus bombardment that a newborn infant would have to confront if her perceptual apparatus weren't constrained in certain fairly serious ways. And also in terms of learning, if you can only focus on a very limited number of objects and processes, activities, then you have a chance to learn how to recognize them more readily and how to respond more appropriately. And then when you elicit feedback, the feedback tells you whether or not you're doing well, you're actually refining your capacities. Mm-hmm. That's why I use the term constraints. And the neonate is... I've sort of already said that there's these two constraints repertoires, which I'm pleased to call them, the neonates and the mothers. The neonate has sensory motor competencies. For instance, a neonate is born with a preference for human-like faces, and even more kind of specifically, human-like faces which are moving slowly enough for the infant with very little foveal kind of acuity mm-hmm. can track. The neonate is also born with a preference for human voices, particularly female voices, and to pick up the sort of the inflections, the intonations of the particularly the female voice, which obviously is very useful. When we get into the maternal constraints repertoires, you'll see how perfectly they match. The neonate is also born with a capacity for motor mimicry. Very, very early, like hours after birth, an infant will imitate or try to imitate the facial expressions of the caregiver within her kind of visual proximity. So that the eyes and the mouth, of course, are extremely important in human faces. So the infant is pre-equipped to look at the face and to imitate whatever kinds of expression is going on in the face. The neonates are also born with species-typical behavior patterns. There are a few of these, but probably the most important in terms of ontogenesis is punctuated suckling, which is unique to our species. Now, all of those constraints I actually sort of characterize as assistance or attention soliciting devices. They are there to excite the attention of the primary caregiver. The sort of the constraint repertoire of mother, the intuitive parenting skills which I mentioned earlier, include affect mirroring. And Holodinsky and Friedelmeier have got this wonderful term, succinct exaggeration of the affect, when the child cries, which triggers the mother's attention, she goes to the child immediately, and she will imitate the sort of the essential, the basic features of the distressed frown, or if the child is smiling, of the smile. So there's this automatic kind of response to the infant, where she repeats, if you like, mm-hmm. or the infant's emotional expression in an exaggerated form to actually sort of pick out the basics, the essential elements of it. I'm not sure that was terribly clear.
No, it was actually, I'm having the image in my head of sort of these two interlocking, you know, puzzle pieces that just where, you know, the infant's, as you call it very nicely, tight world, characterized by these very specific competences that it's born with, fit, you know, they're matched by a corresponding behavior pattern on the part of the caregiver, of the mother, you know, to exaggerate things, to say things, you know, baby talk and exaggerate faces and move slowly. And so it's a very, you know, it's, I mean, it all kind of lends credence to your claim that there's this very deep functional integration where behaviors that we kind of take for granted on both sides are just, you're very, very, you know, closely matched, you know, by evolution to work together to help scaffold, as you put it.
Yes. I mean, I have to say, I was so impressed with it. It's the most wonderful story. And the elegance and the economy of the ontogenic process is truly breathtaking. I mean, you know, even now, I'm just the storyteller. To be in a position to be able to tell the story I just think it's an enormous privilege. But I mean, you know, the baby squawks, mother, the part of her repertoire is a physiological stress reaction. I mean, you can actually measure her galvanic skin response, the blood pressure, and all the rest of it. She's stressed. She has this real urge to go to her infant and put right, you know, what's causing the infant to cry. She mirrors the infant's facial expression and the mother ease, the baby talk commentary that invariably accompanies these kinds of interactions is kind of very simple. It's sing-songy, it's rhythmical, and it exaggerates the kind of prosodic characteristics of human speech. But also, of course, it tells the infant what's wrong. Can I tell you a personal anecdote which really got me into this?
Sure.
When I was in Canada, Anise arrived with her six-month-old and her husband, and we're sitting in the den, I think they're called in Canada, the Amy was in one of these kind of almost like an old-fashioned deck chair, sling thing on the floor, where she could wiggle her legs and things. And anyway, she started to cry, and my niece Christine was over like a shot. It was almost as though she was on an elastic band. She goes, she picks up Amy, and she said, "Oh, Amy, sad, Amy crying." You know, all this baby talk stuff. And then she goes through a search, you know, identify correct routine. Is Amy hungry? And she puts her finger in Amy's mouth, and of course she didn't latch on. Nice sort of relaxed mouth, so she's not hungry. Amy cold? No. And Amy hot? No. Amy done wee wee? If you'll pardon this, it's a great leveler. In the development, Christine's olfactory apparatus picked up the real problem, which was, in fact, there was a rather unpleasant diaper, as Americans call it. Anyway, she was going to make, you know, she says to Amy, and I won't tell you what she said, but she said, you know, then Mummy make Amy, you know, clean and comfy.
Right.
And disappeared upstairs into the makeshift nursery. Well, I'm sitting downstairs with Chris, her husband, and I'm listening to all these coos and ahs and thinking, I know what's going on there. And it's not the sort of thing which would normally cause delight. Anyway, they came back downstairs and they're cooing and they, you know, they're doing all the things that mums and babies do. And I said to Chris, I said, they're in love. And I never thought more about it. But once I started to read about development, that's exactly what mothers do. they don't know when a baby cries, especially new mothers. They haven't got a clue what's wrong. And the affect expressions are what I call referentially opaque. They don't say I've got a headache or I'm cold. They just say, something's wrong. Do something. And that's how they're interpreted, because that's how they're meant to be interpreted by their pre-adapted caregivers. And so she has to go and do what I call the search, identify, correct, kind of get into that kind of process to identify what's wrong with the infant and put it right. And all the time this is accompanied by her baby talk commentary, her mother ease. So you have the neonates with their set of their repertoire of assistance soliciting devices, and you've got the maternal repertoire of assistance providing devices, and they match absolutely perfectly. Well, if mum gets it right, sorry, that's me getting a bit excited here and passing my desk. If mum gets it right, then the next time she hears that kind of a cry, she will try that particular remedy first. If it doesn't work, then she'll try something else. And this will refine her kind of assistance providing devices. And the baby talk commentary and the affect kind of the exaggerated affect expression will generate in the infant the appropriate feelings that match certain kinds of activities. I should have said, of course, that the human neonate is born with proprioceptors and interoceptors, and the interoceptors are throughout the body, and they actually sort of pick up any kind of substantial or significant change in any kind of homeostatic parameter. So if the glucose levels drop or the temperature drops, then the infant will fire off, will start to cry, it will manifest distress. Yeah. The proprioceptors, particularly those in the face, are incredibly important in learning how to emote like a human being. The infant, when let's say smiling, because it's easier to kind of sort of imagine. The infant smiles at say a mobile overhead. Mother goes and says, "Oh, Amy happy, Amy pleased," and gives back this wonderful exaggerated smile, which the infant imitates. Now, with that imitation comes the proprioceptive feeling of the smile. Mm-hmm. How a smile actually feels, and due to this repetitive in every day in out, day in, day out kind of repetition of these interactive cycles. And through the baby talk commentary, the infant will actually learn not only that smiling is associated with happiness, the infant will learn what sorts of things make her happy. And how to sort of get hold of them. And of course, on the other side of things, she will learn what sorts of things make her unhappy and what to do about it. So she will learn the names of the emotions in her culture, their causes, eliciting factors, and what to do to either eliminate or prolong them. Hmm. And all comes as a kind of a package which evolution gives to the human species.
So let me. There's two questions at this point that I want to pursue, and I guess I'll state them both, and you can take them in the order you choose. One is that one of the main implications of your view, and you defend it against a number of objections, is the idea that that the emotions are somehow extended or radically widely realized, and part of that is this idea that there's the functional integration between neonate and mother is just so intertwined that it doesn't make sense to sort of to have a more individualistic view of the emotions. I mean that's sort of one issue, but I think a prior one that I do want to get to is how does this process lead to the what are normally called the higher cognitive emotions. I mean, it's you've mentioned just, you know, the happiness and sadness and learning those, you know, what in a particular culture, you know, are the stimuli that are associated with happiness and which are not, and what are the appropriate reactions and so forth. You know, of course, the higher cognitive emotions are also, on your view, supposed to develop, you know, out of these same precursors and the same deep functional integration. So could you say something about, you know, not so much, you know, sadness or, you know, one of the basic emotions, but how this account also gives a story of a higher cognitive emotion like shame or pride or something like that?
Yes. The higher cognitive emotions, they're supposed to start to develop between 3 and 6 years of age, when the infant is going through the sort of the vocal spurt, when she's learning 10 words a day. And the sort of the basics are already inbuilt. I mean, the thing about the transition from a precursor to basic emotions is we've mentioned the kind of relationship that builds up due to the release of endogenous opioids and prosocial and neurochemicals. But the other side of that is, and of equal importance, is that the auditory, the visual, olfactory, haptic, tactile stimulation that comes with the sort of the cycles of interaction between a mother and baby, at least every 3 to 4 hours when she needs feeding and changing, trigger the release of intraneural genetic products to connect mature neurons. So what happens is these stimuli actually promote a brain growth. So the brain is actually only grown. It's the most expensive organ energy-wise in the body, as you know. But it's only grown as needed to support more complex capacity. That's the sort of the wonderful economy of it. So the basic emotions, when they're the sort of the neural circuits responsible for those, including the amygdala, are laid down during the very early years. You know, as a function of the interaction of the two repertoires. And by the time the infant is 3 and 4, she started to add words to her gestural, vocal gestural kind of communicative systems, which have served her very well up to then. And, of course, as she learns language, by implication, she learns a symbolic thought. And they're supposed to be able to use social referencing at about 11 months. Which is really in very early if you think about it, because they actually see certain kinds of emotional expressions as symbols rather than of something, rather than of genuine kind of emotional expression. But I mean, by the time she's 4, she's got the basic kind of neural capacity to support the linguistic and cognitive capacity upon which her higher cognitive emotions will be built. The mother actually changes her kind of response to the child as the child grows. When the child first reaches and grasps for an object, mother will automatically give it to the child. Always try to fulfill any kind of needs which she perceives. But as the child grows, she wants the child to become more independent, more intrapersonally regulated rather than interpersonally regulated, which is what happens in the very early years. So when the child says do something, you know, the caregiver will say, no, you do it. And if necessary, we'll actually show the child how to do it. She'll correct any pronunciation that is wrong when the child is learning new words. She will by her behaviour, she will get things like pride and shame to, you know, the higher cognitive emotions, the self-evaluative emotions, to develop by actually exactly the same processes, affect mirroring and more. Let's call it linguistic scaffolding, because the mother ease is gone by now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she, you know, if she's proud of Junior, she will mother will actually raise herself up, will stand tall, will be, her gestures will be expansive. She will show the child what sort of behaviors indicate pride, and what sort of behaviors indicate shame. And of course, there will be commentary as well. The kinds of things that a child actually should be proud of having accomplished, and these kinds of things a child should be ashamed of. When he or she transgresses, the maternal behaviour and the kind of linguistic commentary is kind of customised, is tailored to. The developmental status of the child, and that's how she learns them. She learns, you know, when she's feeling jealous. You know, mother will say, "Oh, you're jealous of your sister," and really, that's actually how we learn our higher cognitive emotions too. The same process. We haven't mentioned kind of culture and the influence of culture yet, but certainly sort of child rearing differs in what people call collectivist and individualistic cultures. I mean, the Western democracies are individualistic. We want our children to express their emotions, to be proud of their achievements, and independent. And these are the sorts of things we cherish and we try to develop in our kids. In collectivist cultures in Asia, these are not the sorts of values which are cherished. The sort of the maintenance of social harmony at the expense of the individual's wishes is what really matters. So anger, for instance, is will never to show anger, and will never mirror anger in the infant. She will try to orchestrate the experiences of the infant to minimize the chances of anger. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a whole raft of cultural idiosyncrasies which promote or eliminate or try to eliminate certain kinds of emotional reactions in these different kinds of cultures. Japanese children would more readily manifest sadness than anger. You know, sadness is considered okay in a collectivist culture. It's about but it's certainly being less disruptive. So in that respect, it's more of a social harmonizer than the disruptive behavior that comes with anger. So the child learns, rather than to be angry, as would be expected in Western cultures, for instance, the child will learn to be sad instead.
Mm-hmm.
So this is when a culture really comes in. But I mean, the whole of the sort of intuitive parenting repertoire, mm-hmm, is in by the norms that represent the culture of the mother, plus the distinct emotional ethno theories that we've just been talking about. From the very beginning, what a child learns in terms of both basic and higher cognitive emotions is certainly culturally influenced.
So let me just ask about that. If the repertoire is adjusted, culturally, socioculturally, then are the emotions themselves also, adjusted? And by that, I mean, you can say, okay, in I don't know, Japanese culture, you know, expressing anger is frowned upon in some way. It's not encouraged. But that doesn't say that, you know, the actual repertoire that leads to the development of anger, it's itself any different. I mean, in other words, it's not the emotion itself that is different between cultures, but the expression of the culture, the expression of the emotion within a culture that differs. And so I'm trying to understand if the, you know, functional integration is such that this is how the emotions themselves get scaffolded into, you know, developing, then one would think that the emotions themselves are going to be different in different cultures rather than just their expression being different.
Yes, that's a really good question. And I think to a certain extent it is the case. There does seem to be plenty of research which shows that children born into collectivist cultures are less emotionally, not volatile, but emotionally liberated, perhaps, than children in Western cultures. There's a kind of a general dampening of emotional response in collectivist cultures, or certainly that's what the research shows, and that's due to the kinds of parenting that actually goes on. So I mean, there might be the odd twinge of anger, but a child has to learn what anger is and the sorts of things that cause it and what to do about it. Now, if the exposure to kind of offensive situations is so limited and a spontaneous or natural anger response is discouraged actively by mother, it's interesting. I mean, I think I would think the actual emotion itself is implicated to a certain extent as well as its expression in certain kinds of emotions. Mm. I mean, joy seems to be expressed equally in all cultures. Love, well, no, actually. Love between mothers and children seems to be fairly universal, except when there's abnormality. If you look at sort of cross-cultural studies, so that there are certain kinds of emotions that do seem to be universal in terms of their nature and their expression, and there are others where I think it is not so clear-cut.
Hmm. Okay. So let me. I brought up this before, the idea of extended mind, or as you put it, the contingent transcranialism of the emotions. So
that's a term of abuse, which I from internalists.
Yes, I know. I think it's from Ken Aizawa or somebody came up with that. Let me ask you about that. I mean, you're defending a what you call radically wide view of the emotions, two questions. You know, one, you know, what is your you know sort of basic defense of that view, and also I wasn't sure if you know the emotions themselves were radically wide in some if feeling anger, you know, for example, is wide, or if it's the developmental process that is wide, right? Because the intuition is that we as individuals feel the emotion, even if one were to grant, right, that there is this deep functional integration between, you know, mother and child for the development of the emotions themselves are are individualistic. So you know, one is, you know, what is your defense of that, of the view, and then sort of a kind of intuitive puzzlement about, you know, our sense that, you know, wait a minute, you know, don't we have the emotions individually?
Oh, well, we certainly experience the emotions at individual, at personal level. And rightly so, they evolved to protect, you know, individuals, persons, whole animals. But the processes that realize the emotions, the subpersonal processes, don't experience emotions. I don't have one neuron in my head that emotes. I don't have one muscle in my face which emotes. I emote because of the activity of all these subpersonal mechanisms which are going on, in my view, across the individual external environment border. the functional integration with which I deal, I mean, I characterize, you know, human development as being triggered, you know, by certain stimuli, which are actually causal, and that during the sort of developmental trajectory, the processes between the mother and the neonate become integrated over time. The functional integration becomes more deep and more complex as the child develops the emotions and language, and mother develops sort of fine tunes her repertoire to ensure the appropriate scaffolding. So functional integration comes on a continuum. So you can have, I'm sure this is where the coupling constitution fallacy objection comes in. Of course, you can have causal coupling, which doesn't involve any deep functional integration. I wouldn't deny that. In fact, I argue the point. What I'm saying is that the way things are set up in terms of human development, the depth and the complexity of the functional integration actually increases during the development of the child. I'm sorry, what else did you want me to...
So my understanding of extended cognition is that, you know, like an actual, I mean, in the traditional, or, you know, Clark and Chalmers going back all the way there, you know, that the actual cognitive state, you know, a memory, for example, is not just realized by the brain, by an individual's brain, but it actually, you know, extends into the world, you know, depending on, you know, again, a very close coupling with some sort of devices or other people even. And this has been very, you know, controversial. And this is, of course, where you rightly, you know, mentioned the causation, you know, constitution fallacy, that, you know, yes, there's a lot of causal interactions, but it's wrong to say that this external device is actually a part of your mind, or that your thought is actually realized by, you know, your brain and the external device. And so on that sort of understanding of extended mind, I guess my question was, is anger extended in that way, or you know, whatever, pity, or, you know, whatever your emotion might be, is that extended such that when I feel angry, there's another thing sort of outside me that is actually partly realizing my anger?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I got lost before. Uh-huh. Yes, I mean, you know, a part of my thesis is that, you know, neurons can be deeply functionally integrated with technological artifacts, for instance, you know, Merleau-Ponty's blind man with white sticks, my own experience as a nurse with, you know, feeling abscesses at the end of probes, mm-hmm. And the research around macaque monkeys, where the sort of the brain starts to treat the macaque's forearm hand and the little rake with which he's trying to get hold of the food as one mm-hmm. kind of realizer. And if we look at, say, and I used Wilson's sort of characterization of metaphysical realization, context sensitive kind. Mm-hmm. He rightly says that, you know, realizes something upon which a process or a capacity metaphysically depends, you know, has actually got to be sufficient and necessary, or certainly necessary and sufficient for it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes brains and central nervous systems are just not sufficient. And I use his kind of views, his views on total realizer systems and partial and core realizer systems. Mm-hmm. And very briefly, he says that a core realizer in any total system, which is composed of partial realizers, core and non-core, the core realizer is that process or structure which is considered to be utterly critical for a certain kind of function. So in terms of emotion, the amygdala in adults is considered core. Mm-hmm. My view is that in the ontogenesis of the emotions, the core realizer is actually the relationship that builds up between mother and baby, where, you know, brains are actually built and they're refined at the same time that the relationship, the bonding relationship, is actually built. So we have this modulation going on synchronously, simultaneously, mm-hmm. in two individuals which are party to the same kind of mm-hmm. process. So certainly as far as ontogenesis is concerned, I construe the core realizer as the relationship. Mm-hmm. But in adults, then it's the amygdala, because the amygdala is like other parts of the neural circuitry required for human emotionality, is actually developed from some kind of primitive structure during the ontogenic process. So when the core, as Wilson characterized it, the core realizer actually extends beyond the individual. That's radically wide, and that would be ontogenesis. But the core realizer, your anger, for instance, in adult emotionality, is wide in that the core is in the amygdala, which is brain bound. But the sorts of things which are construed as anger eliciting, offensive, those sorts of things, they are all learned during the development of the emotions. These are socio-cultural constituents. So you have, if you're an adult angry person, you're a wide angry individual, or your emotion is wide. If you're a developing individual who's squawking, then whatever is the core realizer while you're developing is actually the relationship you are building progressively with your caregiver. Was that clear?
Yes, that did help me. Yes, we're actually running out of time, and which is a shame because at the latter parts of the book, you introduce Millikan's theory of proper functions into the picture, and the idea of what emotions are expressions or signs or representations of. And so there's a lot of sort of more linguistic and Millikanian, components to your view that I'm afraid we're not going to get a chance to get to. But let me just ask one, I guess readers will have to just find that stuff out by themselves. I did want to ask at least, one of the implications that you mention at the very end of the book is for example, for the nature of moral development, not just emotional, but moral development. So the development of moral agency. So maybe you could you say something about the implication of your view for moral development as you see it?
Yes, I mean, it was really interesting. I wasn't sure. All of the philosophy books that I've read, they don't actually have a chapter suggesting future research. But, of course, I come from an empirical research background, and we always finish with the chapter on, what's still to be done. I decided to write what's still to be done or what could be interesting in the future. And it's been well received by philosophers. So yes, I mean, it seems to me that moral development has got to be the result of emotional development, linguistic and cognitive development. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be a moral agent, you have to be able to think morally. You have to have the appropriate emotions to motivate your moral activities. And the self-evaluative emotions start to appear between 4 and 6 years. The pride and the shame, they just come in development if you've got the right kind of developmental trajectory, the right kind of experience. I mean, and again, in terms of the metaphysics. The core realizer, in moral development, in the development period, that would be the close relationship because of the dependence of moral behavior, mm-hmm. Morality in general, on emotion, on the appropriate emotions and semantic conceptualization. But the individual, the kind of moral behavior, being empathetic, being kind, being courageous in the right kinds of situations. I think that would be widely realized because the core is actually in the individual by this time. The necessary kind of security has been developed with the right kinds of information stored. Mm-hmm. But what counts as moral in any culture, of course, is socioculturally determined. So I think it'll be really quite interesting to look at moral development. I mean, I suppose moral development is probably the highest pinnacle of the kind of human development there is. It's a way of thinking and behaving in certain kinds of possibly self-sacrificing ways. Mm-hmm. We may not be the only species that self-sacrifices. I mean, animals with various kind of fixed responses to offspring threat might automatically offer themselves, as it were, to a predator. But I mean, it's only human persons who can actually stand and rationalize and work out that it might be better, for somebody or for people in general, if I was not to be selfish, but I was to be other kind of directed, mm-hmm. At my own cost. Then those kinds of thinking and the behaviour which will sort of ensue has got to be a function of cognition and emotion.
Very good.
It could be anywhere else.
Yeah. Well, I think we are out of time. So as a final question again is what's on the horizon for you? Are you going to actually pursue this aspect, or do you have other projects you're already working on now?
Well, I did try to pursue investigating moral development, I put in a couple of grant applications which were unsuccessful, unfortunately. But now I'm actually engaged with a group of philosophers and biologists looking at pain, the phenomenology of pain, and where it appears in phylogeny. There's a whole raft of such interesting stuff that biologists by themselves and philosophers by ourselves don't seem to be able to deal with, to address fully. So we thought if we got together and we put biological and philosophical heads together, we might come up with something which would be really quite exciting.
Very interesting. Well, I wish you luck with that. I appreciate again your taking the time to talk with us on New Books in Philosophy.
Oh, well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
Very good. Okay, well, good evening, or good morning, actually, and good luck with your work.
Thank you very much indeed. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Jennifer Greenwood, academic tutor in philosophy, education, and nursing at the University of Queensland. We've been talking about her new book, Becoming Human, The Ontogenesis, Metaphysics, and Expression of Human Emotionality. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.